Dr. William Luther Pierce on The Jewish Problem, 1997.
Hello. A few weeks ago, I spoke with you about the ongoing Jewish extortion effort against Switzerland. Jewish organizations claimed that Swiss banks were holding onto assets deposited by wealthy Jews in the 1930s and 1940s who later perished during the Second World War and so were never able to retrieve their money. Jews demanded that this money be put into a special fund for so-called Holocaust survivors. More information has come to light about this Jewish extortion campaign, and I want to share it with you today because it helps us to understand better the situation all of us are in. In the first place, let us be clear on the point that what we are talking about is not simply an effort by Jews to get back what rightfully belongs to them. It is not a matter of aging Holocaust survivors, David and Sarah Goldblatt in Miami Beach, trying to get their hands on an account their late Uncle Abe set up in Switzerland before he was hauled off to Auschwitz in 1943 and never seen again. It is, in fact, a massive campaign of criminal extortion, complete with threats, deception, and fraud on a huge scale, and criminal collusion by the Clinton government and the control news media. As I told you when I talked about this earlier, the initial response of the Swiss to the Jewish demand for money was that Jewish depositors always had been treated just like all other depositors, and that Swiss bankers already had investigated their dormant accounts and looked for rightful owners, and that there was, at most, a few million dollars in such accounts, which might belong to relatives of Jews who had died during the war. All David and Sarah Goldblatt had to do to claim Uncle Abe's money was present evidence that it was rightfully theirs. Now this, of course, wasn't what the Jews had in mind at all, and so they began applying pressure and making threats. Switzerland's president at the time, Jean-Pascal Delamuraz, angrily accused the Jews of blackmail and extortion in trying to pressure Switzerland to turn money over to them without any evidence that they had a legitimate claim. But, unfortunately, Mr. Delamuraz was leaving office at the end of 1996, and his successor was more willing to pay blackmail in order to avoid trouble. Just to make sure that the Swiss got the message, the Jews persuaded some of their Christian collaborators to join their campaign. Willing church leaders in Switzerland organized a public demonstration in Zurich by 15,000 churchgoers who demanded that the Swiss government and the Swiss bankers give God's chosen people whatever they wanted and stop accusing the poor, persecuted Jews of blackmail. The Swiss bankers and the Swiss politicians are a bit more hard-headed than these pale, soft, hymn-singing churchgoers, however. Arguments that God's chosen people deserve whatever they want because the Bible says so have little effect on them. The real pressure was being applied to them out of the public's eye. On January 10th of this year, billionaire Jewish liquor merchant Edgar Bronfman, head of the World Jewish Congress, met with the Swiss ambassador to the United States and threatened him that unless Switzerland coughed up $250 million immediately, upcoming congressional hearings by the House Banking Committee would be made as embarrassing as possible for Switzerland. And other pressure was being applied behind the scenes. A group of New York Jews, claiming to be Holocaust victims, brought a class action suit against three of Switzerland's largest banks and petitioned the Federal Reserve Bank of New York to suspend the banking licenses of the defendant banks pending the outcome of the lawsuit. If such a petition were granted, it would cause the banks to lose billions of dollars. Israel got into the campaign when the Jewish agency, headquartered in Jerusalem, hinted that it would call for a worldwide boycott of Swiss banks if the former Swiss president didn't apologize for characterizing the Jewish campaign as extortion. The result of this threat was the apology which had been demanded, and Mr. Clinton's State Department has been cooperating with the campaign by releasing a series of World War II documents, one every week or so, purporting to show that the Swiss were cozy with the Germans during the war. The release of these documents at this time is clearly a ploy calculated to embarrass Switzerland and put pressure on that country to bow to Jewish demands for more and more money. The Swiss already have coughed up the $250 million demanded by Bronfman, and now the Jews are indicating that that is just the first payment. They are suggesting that $7 billion may be a reasonable total amount for Switzerland to pay the Jews. And the Jews claim that they can't understand why so many people hate them. Well, it is clear in this case that the Jews will go for just as much money as they figure they can extort from the Swiss, and not a shekel less. And it is the shekels which count with them, not how many more people learn to hate them as a consequence of this behavior. That's the way it's always been with them. Of course, in this case, it's hard to feel sorry for the Swiss, because they chose to capitulate to the extortion rather than to fight, which is what the Jews calculated they would do. In this democratic era, there just don't seem to be politicians or businessmen anywhere with principles or a sense of honor. Another interesting example of the Jews' characteristic of pushing ahead arrogantly with whatever they believe is advantageous to them without any concern for the hatred which their behavior generates came to my attention recently. The great fad these days, of course, the great media-promoted craze is diversity, and Jews are to be found in every nook and cranny of the diversity movement. Jews produce the diversity propaganda. They agitate for new diversity legislation, and they always are pushing to cram more diversity down our throats. If they see any group of white people, the residents of an apartment building, students in a school classroom, a sports team, a Saturday night poker club, any all-white group, they will try to force the group to accept 3 Zulus, a Chinaman, and a disabled Hispanic lesbian. The idea, of course, is to exterminate us, to wage genocide against us, to leave us with no opportunity to be among our own kind, no opportunity to feel a sense of kinship and belonging among our own people, no opportunity to organize and defend ourselves. They want to be the one and only self-conscious group on this earth, able to act intelligently in promoting their group interests. And then the world will belong to them. And you know, they've been pretty successful so far in their campaign against us. They've been successful because they've kept their motives moderately well concealed, and they've been able to persuade large segments of our own people to collaborate with them in their diversity campaign by convincing them that it's the moral thing to do. The hymn singers are an example. But you know, sometimes their arrogance just runs away with itself and blows their cover. They put out a newsletter called Managing Diversity, which goes to all of the government agencies in Washington. It tells the bureaucrats how they can increase the amount of diversity in their bailiwicks and still keep things under control. It tells them how they can displace more normal white government workers with Hmong tribesmen or wetbacks or AIDS-inflicted alternate lifestylers and still keep the remaining whites from rebelling. In addition to this sort of practical advice, managing diversity also has a lot of sensitivity training articles in its issues. Articles which are supposed to be posted for the white workers to read in order to keep them feeling guilty and cowed. An example is a front page article in a recent issue of Managing Diversity written by Harris Sussman, Ph.D. Dr. Sussman's article is titled, "What Are the Values of White People?" And then this too clever and too arrogant Jewish diversity promoter turns and bites the very hymn singers who have collaborated with him and his kind most eagerly. He writes, and I quote, "It turns out that the white people we are talking about have been primarily Christians, often acting in the name of their Christian values. In the name of Christian values, they had the Inquisition. They called native peoples savages who did not qualify as human beings. They set up definitions of pagans, heathens, primitives, undeveloped people, which left Christians superior and dominant. They killed Jews and gypsies in the Holocaust. In our postmodern vocabulary, whites, or the white man, is all we need to say to invoke this history and experience of injustice and cruelty. When we say white people, we mean the people who value things over people, who value money over people. We know exactly what their values are and where they lead. We have all paid a terrible price for those values." Close quote. Remember, this is a Jew telling us that we Gentiles are too interested in money. In the same article, Dr. Sussman goes on to gloat over what he and his kind already have done to white people with their brainwashing campaign. He gloats over the psychological and spiritual damage his diversity campaign already has caused. And again, I quote, "Many white people are uneasy with their own history. They are having a profound identity crisis. This means that many white people do not think of themselves as white people," he crows. And then he describes the many ways in which guilt-stricken whites are trying to escape from their own identity and conform to what Sussman and his fellow Jews want them to be. He writes that many confused white people are trying to, quote, "adopt the values of native peoples. Look at ecofeminism," he says. "Look at holistic health, Earth Day, the rainbow gathering," end quote. That's from the newsletter Managing Diversity, copies of which can be found in every government workplace in Washington. Sussman figures that the hymn singers will let him kick them in the teeth and then will lick his toes and beg for another kick. And, unfortunately, that's exactly what many of them will do. There's a sort of masochistic tendency among many of them. But there are a lot of us white people who aren't masochists. A lot of us unreconstructed white boys who don't react to Dr. Sussman and his kind the way they want us to. A lot of us who read what he has to say and then make a pledge to ourselves that one day we'll see him and all of his kind swinging and jerking at the end of a rope, no matter what it takes. And you know, there are some old-fashioned Christians among us, too, who'll be helping us haul on the other end of that rope. These two examples of Jewish behavior I've given, the brazen extortion of hundreds of millions of dollars from the Swiss people, and the arrogant gloating about the damage they have done to us with their diversity campaign. These two examples lead us to a closely related subject we've discussed on earlier programs. and that is the so-called Holocaust. We've looked at various aspects of their Holocaust propaganda in the past, and we've uncovered some of their little psychological tricks, such as calling anyone who doesn't swallow the whole myth, lock, stock, and barrel, a Holocaust denier. If you question any of their numbers about how many Jews supposedly were put into gas chambers, if you question a single one of their overblown atrocity stories, then you're a Holocaust denier, implying that you believe that the Germans took no defensive measures at all against the Jews during the Second World War, when in fact you know that the Germans did try to rid themselves of Jewish influence. We've examined some of these tricks of theirs, and we've explored some of their specific lies about the Holocaust, but the question remains, why do they do it? Why do they push the Holocaust business so hard? Why, 55 years after the fact, do they keep playing the same tune? Why do they demand that the American taxpayers provide free land for Holocaust museums for them? Why do they demand that our children in the public schools be subjected to Holocaust propaganda courses? They are aware that many other peoples have gone through their own Holocausts. The Armenians, the Germans, the Ukrainians, the Russians. Why is it only the Jews who keep pushing it? Only the Jews who make it the focus of their lives, the essential core of their identity? Well, we really know the answer to this question now. We understand that they push the Holocaust for two reasons. First, because they make lots and lots of money from it. And second, because it protects them from criticism, enables them to get away with the most outrageous behavior, behavior that would not be tolerated in any other people. They have just collected $250 million in cold, hard cash from the Swiss in blackmail money. Money which the Swiss gave to them not because there was the slightest evidence that the Jews were entitled to any of it, but simply to avoid a boycott. And the Jews are aiming for $7 billion more from the Swiss the same way. Anybody else who tried a stunt like that would end up in prison for extortion. The Swiss government wouldn't have caved in to anybody else either. If, for example, the heirs of the Russian aristocrats who were butchered by Jewish communists in the 1920s had made a similar demand on the Swiss bankers for lost assets, the Swiss would have fought them all the way. But they didn't want to fight the Jews. They even apologized for frankly telling the Jews what they thought about the whole racket, because they knew the Jews would wrap themselves in the Holocaust, and it would look like the Swiss were picking on the poor, innocent, defenseless, persecuted dears. They knew the Jews had them beat at the propaganda game, at the sympathy game. That's just one example of the cash value of the Holocaust. Another example is the $4 billion in American taxpayers' money which goes to the Jews in Israel every year, and the tens of billions of dollars the Jews have extorted from the German people over the past 50 years. Or consider Dr. Sussman's boasting about the damage the Jews' diversity propaganda already has done to the self-image of many gullible white people. Who else but a Jew would have the brass for that? And where does that brass come from? It comes from a sure knowledge that he can retreat into his victim status if anyone calls him to account. He knows that he can invoke the Holocaust, that he can wrap himself in the Holocaust, and his accusers will retreat in embarrassment. At least the hymn singers will retreat in embarrassment, and any harder-headed critic of the Jews or their behavior or their influence knows that he will be regarded as a bully by everyone who has been taken in by the Holocaust propaganda. But the fact is, that we do have a Jewish problem in America. It is by far the biggest and most dangerous problem we have. It is worse than our crime problem, worse than our drug problem, worse than our political corruption problem, worse than our immigration problem, worse even than our race problem. Our Jewish problem, in fact, lies at the root of nearly all of our other problems. If we are to have a future, we must solve it. We cannot let ourselves be buffaloed by the Holocaust. We must face the fact that, regardless of all the nice, inoffensive Jews you may know as individuals, all of the Jews who mind their own business, the Jews as a whole are destroying our society. Their policies are poison to us. And with their control of our news and entertainment media, and their corollary control of our political system, they have a death grip on our country. We must have the courage to stand up to them and to do everything necessary to break that death grip. We must free our media and our government from their influence. We must make an example of the Sussmans and all of their collaborators. Otherwise, they will destroy us as surely as they have destroyed every other society in which they were given free rein. Think about it. But whatever you decide to do, do it. Get in touch with me, and let's do it together. Thanks for being with me again today.